So we're working our way through Matthew's Gospel, and our passage this morning is Matthew 21, verses 1 to 11. And it seems to me that the message of this passage, the main thing that it's saying to us, is contained in three words. You find them in verse 5, these words: behold your king. Behold your king. Our king, of course, as Christian men and women, is Jesus. But even though we know that's true, it may still be that we've gone some time without really beholding him. We've been tied up with school, with work, with deadlines, with pressures, with problems, with all sorts of different things. And so for days, perhaps for weeks, for months even, we've hardly considered our king. Matthew 21, 1 to 11 is urging us this morning, stop, refocus, behold your king. Now in the passage, two main things happen. We have in the first place, Jesus securing for himself a means of transport for the last leg of his journey to Jerusalem. And we have secondly, an accompanying crowd responding enthusiastically to that development. And put like that, I suppose these two events that dominate our passage don't sound all that exciting. But this is the thing. Matthew wants us to appreciate something. He wants us to appreciate that these two events relate to passages in the Old Testament. In particular, there are three Old Testament passages that Jesus is fulfilling, and it's when we grasp that, when we grasp how Jesus is fulfilling those passages, that we're really able to behold our King here. And to behold, then, three marvelous things about him. First of all, this morning, he's a king who differs from the norm. He's a king who differs from the norm. So the most obvious Old Testament passage being fulfilled by Jesus is Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9. Matthew spoon-feeds us that one. Verse 4, he says, this took place to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet, saying, say to the daughter of Zion, behold, your king is coming to you, humble and mounted on a donkey and on a colt, the foal of a beast of burden. Now, Zechariah had his prophetic ministry toward the end of the Old Testament period after the return of God's people from the Babylonian exile. And in some ways, that return from exile ended Judah's humiliation. God's people had been forced to live in an alien land within an alien culture, but now they were back on their own turf, able to rebuild Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. In some ways, the humiliation was over. But in other ways, it continued. God's people after the exile were still under the rule of foreign powers. No autonomy, no independence, no self-governance. Put simply, Judah had no king. And so when Zechariah utters his famous words then, the mere fact that he mentions a king, Judah one day having a king, that in itself makes his prophecy notable. But Zechariah goes further. He doesn't just mention a king, he gives a brief description of him. And it's this description that's the really arresting part of the prophecy. He describes the king riding on a donkey. Now, we need to be sensitive to cultural considerations here. When we think of donkeys being ridden, we perhaps think of the seaside and some mangy-looking beast with a child on its back shuffling along the promenade at about a quarter of the pace of your average snail. And so the whole idea then of a donkey as a serious means of transport strikes us as somewhat ludicrous. In the ancient world, however, donkeys were serious and effective means of transport, and it's not uncommon in the Old Testament to find people riding donkeys. So it's not the riding of a donkey per se that makes Zechariah's prophecy arresting. It's rather the idea of a king riding a donkey. That's what's arresting. Some of you may have seen the Johnny English comedy films. Johnny English, played by Rowan Atkinson of Mr. Bean fame, is an agent in MI7 and an extremely inept one. He keeps messing things up and getting into all kinds of scrapes. And my favourite scene in the films is one where he's in a very serious meeting, discussing the mission that they're working on at that point. And the participants in the meeting then are sitting around this high table, and Johnny English is on a kind of office swivel chair. And at one point he feels the need to adjust the chair slightly, so he puts his hand down to mess around with the lever, and the lever comes off in his hand. And so the chair starts to lower, and he can't do anything to stop the chair from lowering, and down and down and down the chair goes. And in the end then, he's so low that he can only just see above the table to the other people who are sitting at it. And it's funny then, because he's supposed to be this important figure in the higher echelons of Britain's national security. And people like that, people with that kind of eminence, normally flaunt themselves and throw their weight around and make it known that they have clout. But far from doing that, this senior MI7 agent is in this ridiculously low seating position, trying to peer over the top of the table at his rather bemused colleagues. And kings in the ancient world then, they flaunted themselves. They threw their weight around. They made it known that they had clout. And not least, they did that in the way that they travelled. Do you remember Samuel's grave warning to the Israelites in 1 Samuel chapter 8? The Israelites had requested a king. And that request, you remember, doesn't go down too well with Samuel. And he says to them then, in a long section there in 1 Samuel 8, if you have a king, this is what he will be like. And he gives this lengthy description of the most pompous, self-regarding kind of ruler. And it begins in 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 11. It begins in this way. He says there that this king, he will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. So you see what he's saying? He's saying this king that you're hankering after, Israel, amongst other things, he will parade his importance in this way. He will thunder along the highways in impressive chariots pulled by horsemen on which your sons will be riding. That's what he will do. And why did Samuel think like that then? Why did Samuel envisage Israel having a king being like that? Where's he gotten the idea from? Well, from the other nations that already had kings. That's what their kings did. Their kings thundered along the highways in chariots pulled by horses. And so, as I say, kings in the ancient world, they flaunted themselves, not least in the way that they travelled. But the king that Zechariah prophesies, he's not going to do that. He's going to be like Johnny English, like the agent sitting in that meeting in a way that seemed out of keeping with his status. This king will travel in a way that seems out of keeping with his status. On a donkey of all things. Actually, Samuel's description goes on to talks about this pompous, self-regarding king using donkeys, but using donkeys as a work animal out in the fields. That's where donkeys belong for a normal ancient Near Eastern king, not as a means of royal transport. To be sure, King David on one occasion rides a donkey, but that's in the humiliating circumstances of fleeing Jerusalem because Absalom has taken over the city and taken the throne from him. And so a rather pathetic means of transport was a significant departure from the ancient world's typical swaggering version of kingship. The king Zechariah describes is clearly one who differs from the norm. And at this point, we need to note the inadequacy of my Johnny English analogy. You see, Johnny English adopts that very unimpressive seating position because of a mishap with the chair's mechanism. Zechariah's king doesn't adopt this very unimpressive means of transport because of a mishap. He does so by choice. He does so because of his character. He's humble, the prophet says. In the last analysis, then, that's how this king in Zechariah 9:9 differs from the norm. Not merely in this outward circumstance of how he gets about, but in the character that underlies that choice. He, Zechariah says, is humble. He differs from the norm of ancient Near Eastern kings by being humble. And here in Matthew 21, then, as Jesus approaches Jerusalem on a donkey, he's fulfilling that passage, most obviously, most basically. He's fulfilling that passage. He's the king, Zechariah foretold. He's the king who differs from the norm in being humble. And so let's pause and do what we said we were going to do in our introduction. Let's behold our king. And let's behold him in this capacity then, in his extraordinary, humble character. This is the reason, is it not, why many of us in this room have unhesitatingly thrown ourselves down at the feet of this king in total unreserved allegiance. Imagine for a moment that you're in conversation with someone from China and you're asking them about daily life in that country. And the person starts to open up about the authorities in China and the way that the authorities monitor people's internet use, the websites they browse, the online purchases they make, the way the authorities install elaborate surveillance devices in towns and cities with sophisticated facial recognition technology, the way that till recently the authorities even regulated that most intimate and personal area of life, human reproduction. And as you listen to all of this then, you feel this mounting sense of outrage until eventually you can hold it in no longer. That's awful, you shout out. How can you cope with leaders who are so invasive and all-consuming? Anyway, the conversation moves on, and the person wants to find out a bit about you. And soon you're telling your Chinese friend that you're a Christian, that Jesus is your king. And the person's very interested in that. So how does King Jesus affect your daily life then? The question comes. Oh, comprehensively, you answer. The way I spend my money, the way I do my job every day. It's all for King Jesus. He even rules over the most intimate and personal areas of my life, like marriage and sex and raising children. And as you talk like that then, the person from China looks increasingly baffled, perhaps even a little irritated. And as soon as you finish, you're met with an indignant response. But a moment ago, you labelled our Chinese authorities invasive and all-consuming. What about your King Jesus then? It sounds like you've surrendered your whole life to his control. How is that any difference? And you start to smile. And you say, my friend, there's all the difference in the world. My King Jesus is good. His character is humble. I can hand over the control of my life to him because he's no pompous, self-regarding ruler who will take advantage of me and diminish me. He will rule me gently and tenderly and lovingly with my best interests at heart, like a shepherd with his sheep. His lordship over my possessions and my time and my relationships, far from reducing me to servitude, only elevates me and enriches me and ennobles me. There's nothing sinister about this king exercising such a total, all-encompassing rule over his subjects' lives. If he were a proud dictator, then yes. If he were an egotistical tyrant, then yes. But that's not what he is. This king differs from the norm. He's humble, beautifully, adorably, sublimely humble. That's what you say to your friend from China. So if you're a Christian then, this morning, behold your king, I'm saying. Behold your king in this light. Behold your humble king. And if you're not a Christian, if you haven't yet thrown yourself down at King Jesus' feet as his willing subject, why on earth not? Why would you not want him as your king? There's no one like him. Come this morning to the king who is different, the king who differs from the norm, the king who is nothing like any other ruler this world has ever seen. Come to the humble king. Come to King Jesus. He's a king who differs from the norm. But then notice with me secondly this morning, he's a king who takes away the curse. He's a king who takes away the curse. So if Zechariah 9:9 is the most obvious Old Testament passage being fulfilled by Jesus, let me now tell you about the least obvious. And for this one, we're going much further back in our Bibles. I said Zechariah prophesied toward the end of the Old Testament period. The prophecy we're now going to consider comes from the book of Genesis, when the Old Testament period was in its infancy. It's Genesis chapter 49. There, one of that book's major figures, Jacob, is about to die. But before he dies, he gathers his sons around him. These are the sons from whom, of course, the 12 tribes will come. And he says in Genesis 49, verse 1, "I shall tell you what shall happen to you in days to come." And then he works through all his sons, making prophetic comments about the tribes that will eventually come from them. And fairly early on in that passage, he comes to his son Judah. And for an initial couple of verses, what he says about this tribe's future is fairly generic and lacking in explicit detail. But that suddenly changes in Genesis 49, verse 10, where Jacob continues, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet." And then it's best to adopt the reading we have in the footnote that the NIV has in its main text, "until he comes to whom it belongs, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples, binding," Jacob continues, "his foal to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine." So the first part of that then is prophesying that Judah in general will be a royal tribe. But then the focus changes halfway through verse 10 to a specific ruler from Judah. "Until he comes," Jacob says. And this specific ruler then, number one, is so significant, he's the reason Judah's kingship exists in the first place. He's the one to whom it belongs. Number two, he will exercise an international reign. The obedience of the peoples will be his. And number three, he will have a donkey. But notice here, the emphasis is not on the donkey as a means of transport, and thus on the king's humble character, like in Zechariah 9. Here, the emphasis is on the parking arrangements with this donkey. Where does this king leave his donkey? He leaves it tied to a vine. What's the significance of that? Well, the significance of that is that it's an extremely unusual place to leave your donkey. Vines were this precious source of a supreme delicacy, grapes. And if you tied your donkey to a vine, then for one thing, the weight of the donkey pulling against it might well damage the vine. And for another thing, the donkey is going to think that all its Christmases have come at once, and it's going to munch away on those grapes until that vine has been stripped bare. So you didn't tie your donkey to a vine. And if this king is going to tie his donkey to a vine, it means either he doesn't have a clue what he's doing, or his reign involves such excess, such bounty, such fertility in the very natural world that you can afford to snap a vine by tying a heavy animal to it. You can afford to lose a pile of grapes in order to satisfy the appetite of a hungry donkey. And that surely is the point. In fact, any doubt about that is dispelled in the next part of Jacob's prophecy, where he pictures this king washing his garments in wine. You can even do that, Jacob says, under this king. Such is the abundance and fertility that his reign engenders. And it's worth thinking about this prophecy in terms of the flow of the book of Genesis. The book has begun, or pretty much begun, in a garden. A garden containing every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. Chapter 2, verse 9. And that lush garden was presided over by a king, King Adam. He reigned there. And for a while that worked, until one day disaster struck. King Adam rebelled against God. He blatantly disobeyed and defied his maker. And one of the consequences of that was a curse. A curse was imposed by God, whereby the fertility and bounty that had prevailed before was replaced with thorns and thistles, with a barren, unaccommodating environment. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, God now announced. What a terribly depressing turnaround had occurred. But here now, we're at the other end of Genesis, chapter 49. And suddenly there's this refreshing glimmer of hope. Another king is being promised. Another king who clearly is going to reverse the mess caused by King Adam. He's going to take away the curse, uprooting the thorns and thistles, replanting Eden with its fruit-laden trees and irrepressible fertility, so much so that the laundry will be done in pools of wine and donkeys will be parked by grapevines. And here in the first couple of verses of Matthew 21 then, as Jesus sends off these disciples to fetch for him a donkey and its colt, we know what's going to happen. And so we're already thinking, as we read that, we're already thinking in terms of means of transport and Zechariah's prophecy. But if you're reading Matthew's gospel for the first time, you're not thinking like that as he sends off the disciple pair. No one has said anything yet about the donkey being ridden. And in fact, a couple of details there are likely to send you in the direction of Genesis 49 rather than Zechariah 9. For one thing, Jesus specifically says in verse 2, the donkey will be tied. Tied. So that explicitly connects this to the Genesis prophecy. And for another thing, what's it tied to? Well, we're not told, you say. Indeed, we're not. But where is this village in which the donkey is tied up? It's on the Mount of Olives, verse 1. This tree place. Perhaps we're meant to imagine on that basis that the donkey is tied to some fruit tree or other. And we're supposed to recognize then that this is the king of whom Jacob all those centuries ago spoke. Jesus fulfills that Old Testament passage too. He's the king who undoes King Adam's rebellion. He's the king who overturns the consequences of that rebellion. He's the king who takes away the curse. Quite often at Christmas time, there will be a story in the news about some Christmas attraction somewhere that has caused outrage by being so rubbish, by falling so massively short of the hype that was surrounding it. This is one newspaper's description of a particularly spectacular failure in 2008. A Christmas attraction so miserable that the organisers faced trial on charges of misleading advertising. Ringwood's Lapland became a gold standard for dreadful Christmas events. The advertised magical tunnel of lights was some fairy lights on a couple of trees. The snow-covered nativity scene turned out to be a sheet of plywood in a muddy field. And three elves were accused of being involved in violent confrontations. And Christianity, then, is a big religion. It has spawned denominations and traditions and art and forms of governance and culture. Christianity is a big thing in history, a big thing in this world. And perhaps you're not a Christian this morning. And you're wondering, is there really anything behind all this hype? If you strip all of that stuff away, does Christianity actually offer anything of substance? Or just some silly, empty, irrelevant religious froth about finding your inner security or being a nice person or whatever it might be that's really as disappointing as that Christmas attraction? I want to say to you, Christianity offers something of substance. At the heart of Christianity is a king who, get this, a king who restores the broken universe. No less. A king who heals the cosmos. A king who takes away the curse that's presently spoiling everything. That's what this king is going to do. This king is going to come back again one day. He's going to break into history one more time and end history. And then there will be that, do you remember that word we saw in chapter 19, verse 28? That regeneration. That regeneration of the world born again, brought to new birth, paradise restored, Eden reinstated. That's how unfrothy Christianity is. That's how concrete and substantial this religion is. At its heart is a king who heals the very universe. And again, then I say to you this morning, why would you reject him? Why would you hold him at arm's length? Why would you say, no, thank you, Jesus? What have you got that would ever warrant turning Jesus away? What do you have instead that's better than this king, this universe remedying king? Come to him this morning. And if you are a subject of King Jesus, behold your king. Your eyes perhaps have moved away from him. You've lost a sense of wonder. You've lost a sense of his bigness. He's just my king. And it's just there in the background of your thinking. He's this king. This king, the answer to the world's greatest problems. He's not just a king who just dabbles with things on the edge of reality. He's the king who restores the universe. Behold him and be excited afresh by him. So he's a king who differs from the norm. He's a king who takes away the curse. And then thirdly and finally, he's a king who heads for the altar. He's a king who heads for the altar. Because we have then one more Old Testament passage being fulfilled here in Matthew 21, 1 to 11. It's in verse 9 of our passage. In verse 9, the psalm that I read to you earlier on, Psalm 118, is being fulfilled. Now, Psalm 118 is about a king. That may not have been obvious from the part of it that I read to you. But earlier on in that psalm, verses 10 to 12, the main character, the speaker in Psalm 118, he speaks of these immense victories that he has achieved. Verse 10, all nations surrounded me. In the name of the Lord, I cut them off. They surrounded me on every side. In the name of the Lord, I cut them off. And so it goes on. This is no kind of ordinary Israelite worshipper or something. This is a king. This is an impressive kingly figure. And what he's doing then in the latter stages of the psalm that I did read to you this morning is this. He's leading God's people in the observance of one of their great festivals. And so there's this language of kind of going through the gates. That's the gates of Jerusalem, or perhaps the gates of the temple. And this language of approach. And in verses 25 to 27 then, you have the people kind of in this procession being led by the king. to Jerusalem and to the observance of this festival, you have them kind of willing him on and exhorting him and encouraging him. Blessed is he, verse 26, who comes in the name of the Lord. And then at the end of verse 27, kind of willing him on to get to the altar and to indeed observe the festival by offering the appropriate sacrifice. And here in Matthew 21, then, you can see how very appropriate this connection is, because as we said before, this is Passover time, and that's why there are so many crowds heading for Jerusalem, because they're going there from Galilee and from other parts of Israel to celebrate Passover. And it's very appropriate then that they take on their lips, these crowds, the words of Psalm 118 and will on this King, Jesus, as he's on his way to celebrate Passover. It's interesting, however, that they stop, don't they? They stop short in verse 9 of quoting all that you would perhaps expect them to quote from Psalm 118. Or at least if they did quote it, Matthew stopped short of recording it all. Because you would think, wouldn't you, that the kind of the climactic bit of Psalm 118 in the context is verse 27, bind the festal sacrifice with corns up to the horns of the altar. They're on their way to Jerusalem to celebrate Passover, and that then would be the appropriate climactic bit for the crowd to shout, go on, Jesus, our King, go to the altar and offer the sacrifice. But Matthew omits that, if the crowd did say it. And not just does he omit it, but he in fact changes the tone altogether, doesn't he, here? Because what he does go on to tell us in verse 10 is about the reaction of the city of Jerusalem as Jesus and the Galilean pilgrims turn up. And we must be clear what kind of reaction that is. When he entered Jerusalem, the whole city was stirred up. It means in a hostile sense, I think. The last time this kind of language has been used was back in chapter 2 of the Gospel, where, remember, the Magi have arrived in Jerusalem. And we read in chapter 2, verse 3, Herod the king, when he heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Jerusalem was stirred, was troubled then by Jesus, the King of the Jews. And it was no small agitation, was it? In fact, what flowed from that was an attempt to eliminate Jesus. Herod sending his soldiers to try and wipe him out. And I think we're meant to infer that it's that kind of reaction to Jesus here in verse 10 by the people of Jerusalem again. And that this will result in them trying to eliminate Jesus, just as Herod did before. But this time, Jesus isn't escaping, going off to Egypt. This time he's walking towards it. He's walking into the hostility. And so it's pretty ominous and sobering stuff there in verse 10. And you think, well, why doesn't Matthew just stay with Psalm 118 and give us that encouraging climax there? Go up and offer the sacrifice, King Jesus, at the altar. Why does he have to change the tone and bring in this very disturbing and ominous note in verse 10? Well, I think the answer is this, that in verse 10, Matthew is, if you like, continuing the allusion to Psalm 118. And verse 10 is the equivalent of verse 27 of that psalm. And in verse 10, we are seeing Jesus on his way to the altar to offer himself as the sacrifice. That's what the hostility of Jerusalem will result in. Jesus being killed, Jesus being tied to an altar, the cross of Calvary. And so Jesus, by walking into that hostility, he is being the king of Psalm 118. Going to the altar to offer the sacrifice, only in his case, the sacrifice isn't some bleating lamb in his hands. The sacrifice is himself. Why? Why does King Jesus offer himself? Why does he head to the altar to offer himself as a sacrifice? Well, because all that which I've spoken of this morning about the curse being removed and the regeneration of the world, a new world coming, which will be perfect. You and I can't be part of that because we're too dirty, we're too imperfect, we're too sin-stained. The only way we can is if a sacrifice is offered, a sacrifice that removes our dirt and our filth and our imperfection. And that's why King Jesus heads for the altar to lay down his own life on Calvary's altar, so that we can believe in him, and through believing in him can be part of that new world that he is ushering in. Again, is Jesus your king in that sense? Your self-sacrificing king, the king who put himself on the altar at Golgotha? Again, if not, why reject him? You need a sacrifice. This is the only one that will work for you. There's a king here who has laid down his life for you. Come to him. And if you're already his, behold your king. Behold your king who heads so bravely, so lovingly for the altar. Not in Solomon's temple or Herod's temple, but the altar outside the city walls, the altar of the cross. Who heads there to shed his blood for you. Marvel at him. Enjoy him. Love him. Amen.